This is the Sarcastic Voyage Podcast.
This is podcast number 4, featuring Ron Algar-Watt, Matt Robotham, and Chris Fourthman Coleman. Talking recently with a good friend of mine who's similarly afflicted by this condition we call the 30s, when one or the other of us, who can remember, brought up the fact that kids these days just don't know the value of a good porn quest. It's sad that a decade and a half of technological progress means that today's teenage boy will never know the thrill of reaching under his dad's mattress and pulling out a dog-eared copy of Playboy or a discreetly labeled videotape. Okay, so my dad drew a big X with a circle around it on his, but I bet your dad was more subtle about it. Or training your eyes to go one vibrational cycle shy of epileptic to make sense of the scrambled nudity on the higher cable channels. Or, in perhaps the most desperate and pathetic example of my own adolescence, dumpster diving behind Stop, Look, and Listen in hopes of finding a discarded box for Debbie Does Ernest or whatever the porn du jour had been. Equally sad is the fact that we're already saying things like, kids these days have it so much easier, but the thing is, it's true. The internet has made kids weak. And it's not just the porn. As a young smartass, I remember choosing the most bizarre and obscure subjects when the time came around to write reports, and inevitably I'd be driven to frustration and most likely making stuff up, as my local library, which had maybe twice as many books as we had at home, came up short. Back in those bleak, sunless days of the mid-1980s, I was at the mercy of my local librarian and her mysterious associate, Mr. Dewey Decimal. If they couldn't help me, I could not be helped. I suspect that these former power brokers are perhaps the worst casualties of the information age. Because as much as I generally like and respect your average librarian, hi Matt, who really needs them anymore? I mean, sure, you need people physically at the library to make sure homeless people aren't using Redbook as toilet paper or flashing their trench coats open in the young adult section, though I bet those kids have already seen worse on the internet. But aside from helping those few elderly stragglers who insist on using a freaking card catalog in the 21st century, they seem largely obsolete at this point. You know who else hates all this information at our fingertips? Retailers. Your average salesman cannot stand the fact that we can research a product and pricing information before we even set foot in their store. And don't even get me started on travel agents. Because seriously, unless you're planning a multi-stop jaunt across Europe or something, what can some weenie at a keyboard do that you cannot do at your own keyboard? Very little in my experience. I suppose these disenfranchised people do have a point in a certain sense. It must indeed be frustrating that any idiot with a laptop and a Wi-Fi card thinks he's an expert on pretty much anything. But those people existed when we had PBS documentaries and encyclopedias, so I suspect they always will. The internet just makes them more ridiculous, and consequently easier to spot. And speaking of encyclopedias, that's who I feel the most sorry for in all this, the encyclopedia salesman. That was pretty thankless work to begin with, lugging all those books around door to door. Now, unless you're peddling to those same old folk who are quaintly looking things up in their goddamn card catalogs, you're out of luck. A moment of silence, please, for that poor kid who had a report due on space, and the disembodied voice who pushed him into a complete Encyclopedia Britannica set. Really, though, this is an incredible age in which we live. Between Wikipedia, which is essentially the idea Douglas Adams had for a real-life Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy just prior to his death, IMDb and TV.com, most of the information I need is two clicks away. That's one click for the link and one to close the damn pop-up ad. Oh, and then there's the YouTube, which, pardon my cliché, is addictive and pleasurable, like crack cocaine. If I could have all the hours back that I spent on the YouTube watching old Sesame Street clips or the intros to shows I love in the 80s or rare clips of stuff I've actually enjoyed since after I actually hit puberty, well, I'd probably be able to tack on an extra few months to my life. And on a more basic level, I think this whole situation has spoiled people like me. With infinite knowledge at my fingertips, not only do I not have to work for anything, but I also never get anything done. It's a bit of a nightmare for someone as attention deficient as I, this constant parade of increasingly shinier objects. That Eastern ideal that the journey is more important than the destination is starting to make a lot more sense to me in light of this situation. I almost miss those old quests of my youth, digging through bins for old comics or music or books. Everything's just so damn easy these days. Sometimes having the infinity of human knowledge at your fingertips isn't the blessing it appears to be. I think that was probably an old Star Trek once, or maybe a Twilight Zone. I could probably go check, but then I get distracted and never finish this thing. Then again, I do sometimes wish I could get back all that time I spent in my 20s looking for the soundtrack to Fletch. Only to eventually discover just how horrible it was. Only I could have those months of my life back. I'd add them to the reclaimed YouTube months, tack them onto the end of my life, then probably waste them watching porn. which, to bring this thing full circle, is far too easy to find these days. In summary, internet good and bad. Complex conclusions like this are why you count on me to do the mental heavy lifting.
Panel discussion.
All right, here we go. Week 4. On the line with me, appropriately, is Chris Coleman, a.k.a. Fourth Man. Chris, thanks for being on.
Hello!
And with me, as always, is Garth. Or Matt, one of those. Wow, I'm
sure.
I'm bombing over. Okay. Yes, yeah, so on the line with me are Chris Coleman, a.k.a. Fourth Man, and Matt.
Hey.
Gentlemen.
Oh, yes. I can't believe you lost me on the Garth reference. Jesus,
well,
Christ.
It's actually nice because, and of course now I'm tipping my hand, but for the longest time people realized and tried to put together with me the fact that Garth's last name in the Wayne's World movies is Algar.
Oh, yeah. Ugh.
No, oh, no not... connection whatsoever. Total coincidence.
God, that never even occurred to me either.
Yeah, well, now I'm throwing it out there. So.
Apparently, I don't spend nearly enough time thinking about Wayne's World.
I get that too. I have a film reference. People think that my Fourth Man refers to Planetary, the comic book series.
When we first met online, I thought that myself.
I assumed that up until this moment.
But it comes from a. This is very difficult to explain. It comes from a. Early Paul Verhoeven film from 1979, and the
Paul
lead
Verhoeven,
character.
Just to be clear, the guy responsible for RoboCop and Showgirls, correct?
And Basic Instinct and Starship.
Okay,
what a resume.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue.
So
I'm sorry.
Yeah, this is an early Black Widow story that he did, and the lead character is the fourth in a series of potential husbands for this Black Widow, but it turns out that he's a drunken Catholic. Bisexual writer, and only two of those things apply to myself.
We'll leave it up to the audience which of those two. We don't want to tip our hand entirely.
Exactly. But I saw the movie in college. I thought it was good, and it never even occurred to me that sort of giving myself that moniker would bring any kind of aspersions. Like it was
it wasn't a reference yet. I mean,
it wasn't a reference.
Like it was obscure, so you know.
But what I'm saying is, I saw this movie had complete taboo subjects in it, and it's a completely non-mainstream film. It's not there's an on-screen genital mutilation in the film that's just a film that is so far outside of the mainstream stream. It never occurred to me.
So that, fun for the whole family.
Yeah, exactly. But it never occurred to me that I would have to explain, like I would have to put a disclaimer on my name and explain.
Well, it all comes back to genital mutilation, which really you just leave it at that, and we're good. Strangely enough, Matt and I on Instant Messenger yesterday were talking about this very subject.
Yeah, it's all we talk about.
It comes up a lot more than you would think.
Not as much as incest does.
It's true, and actually, this is something. I feel like, and bear with me for a sec here, I feel like we recorded an extra long podcast last time, which ended up getting sort of cut. We cut out the part that we thought was a little slow, and we ended up sharing the part that we thought was funny. But in the part that got cut out, it was revealed, and I think in fairness I need to reveal this in proper canon here. I have a thing for incest, for fictional incest, not for real incest, but for in my
fiction. I've heard what you're talking about. I heard the recording, and I know that I'm responsible for at least one of the things that you're.
It's true. You introduced me to the series by George R. R. Martin, the fantasy books. What's the official name of that series?
Song of Ice and Fire, when it's written, it looks like one of those crazy. I don't even know what to call it, but the font is all screwed up when you write it on the internet because it's capital A, capital S, little O, capital I, little A. And F. So it's ASOIAF, A Song of Ice and Fire.
Ah.
Oven and lowercased when you write it out in its initials.
For a minute there, and I'm going to go a little obscure here, you reminded me of Lois Lane in Superman 2, where she's climbing up the Eiffel Tower and she's going, Pulitzer Prize, capital P, little U, little L.
I'd forgotten that. Wow, I have not seen Superman 2 in some time.
Actually, and that sort of brings me. Well, let me finish the
incest. The incest
coming out of the closet with the fictional, again, fictional incest. Very important to stress that point.
Incidentally, yes. If the people at home could make a song about Al liking using the "I like incest" clip, that would be great.
Oh, and I will completely participate if you need me to. You know, don't think that it has to be an out of context thing. I will, if you want to, you know, make an incest song, I'm all for it.
If you make it, we will totally play it. You can be heard by literally dozens of people.
You have to use the word bro. That's a requirement in the
yes.
in any incest song.
What's up, use it bro? Constantly.
Never not be using it. But no, there's this fantasy series. There's of course Arrested Development, which is rife with many layers of incest and new layers occurring to me every time I watch the show.
Sure.
And then Back to the Future. I'm sorry?
I'm also a fan of both Back to the Future and Arrested Development. I don't think it's a thing. I think that you're just pointing out qualitatively things that are good that happen to have incest in it. Because I don't think it's rare to be a fan of Back to the Future. To be a fan of all three of the things that you've cited so far.
I suppose that's true. However, basically what I'm trying to do here is in our premiere episode, Matt admitted freely and openly that he had dated a furry, that he knew furries.
True. That was great.
And I thought to get us on the same level that I need, you know, not to one up him. It's not that. It's just I feel like
if it is that, then you win. But
no, I really feel like you did stick yourself out there legitimately. Like, I'm trying not to mock you for that because it was good radio, I think. And because it's an interesting thing about you, and because if I make fun of you, you won't talk about it anymore. So I need to pretend that it's interesting and normal. But also sort of part of that tactic is to say, no, I'm into weird shit too. Look, incest. And now, Chris, thank you.
That's fine. Matt, how does that come out? How does that, when my approach to any idiosyncrasy I have, is, you know, well, at least in theory, this is never, I've never actually used this, is to sell all my idiosyncrasies as a positive. Like, you know, if you're with me, you get to dress up in a furry outfit. How did that come out to you in the course of, did you meet that way, or is that, how was it revealed to you that you were dating a furry?
It just sort of happened, you know, like we were getting to the end of the relationship because she was nuts and I hated her. And when I say she was nuts, I don't mean by the whole like, oh, my girlfriend was nuts, you know, and that's, she was legitimately crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. She was stalking me. She would hit me. Yeah, this is comedy gold, by the way. Anyway.
actually, beating you up is kind of comedy gold.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure, for you guys.
I'm picturing a chick putting on a Pikachu suit and kicking the crap out of you. And tell me that's not funny.
She was also an artist, and she would draw a lot of stuff, like a lot of really unpleasant Pokemon fan art.
Oh.
Yeah, and I would get this stuff, and hey, Matt, I drew you a picture. Oh, all right, let's see here. Wow. what is this? That's you as a Pikachu, fucking me.
Collect them all.
You haven't kept any of this. I
oh God, no, no.
Because we're always looking for good cover art for the iTunes, for the podcast.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Damn. Plus,
the last thing I want is anything of hers showing up in any way related to this, because then she can find me.
That's fair. That's fair. And I do think that it's an important line between, you know, let's mock this person in generalities and let's get specific. I mean, by all means, if you're trying to hide from this person, we can certainly move to.
I mean, with any luck, she's killed herself by now. But
nice. You've opened the door you can't close. You realize that.
I know.
Okay.
Is there a furry suicide hotline?
The thing is, I don't have a problem with furries. I have a problem with crazy people.
Yeah, no, I think I made it clear last time.
I've been really depressed lately, you know.
So, what are you wearing?
Well, it's have you ever seen one of the Gamorrean guards from Empire Strikes Back?
Oh yeah.
Or is it Jedi?
No,
Jedi actually.
No, I haven't actually.
And the call. And
never,
the call.
Never. sorry, you verboten. Verboten.
this is not the life I'm looking for.
That actually brings me to a topic that I need to establish here early on. Of course, the Star Wars references. And again, this does not apply to the guest. You are free to make as many Star Wars references as you like. And
Oakley doakley.
I'm sorry to kill your
oh,
joke
you
there. But this is very hard for us. We have decided, your mother and I have just... No. That's what this feels like, though. We're sitting you down. We're having a long prank talk with you. Matt
Chris,
and I have,
we're getting a divorce.
We've decided to remove Simpsons references, all references to The Simpsons, from our comedy repertoire.
Endeavors.
Yes. We.
What about Ron Goldman? Never mind.
Ron, no, you... Oh, got it. Got it.
The other Simpsons.
Right. We have decided that because it's kind of a crutch, and because it, basically it's the same as Star Wars, where everyone knows these references, everyone makes them all the time, they're so easy, we want to make it a little harder for ourselves, we want to challenge ourselves to try to be a little original just once, and so we're going to cut ourselves off from it, we're going to try really damn hard.
Now, you might be sitting at home right now just thinking, oh, pff, yeah, they're not going to use Simpsons
references. Yeah, you're not going to talk about a cartoon, so what?
Whoop-dee shit. You don't understand. Simpsons references to us are like grammar.
It is. Well, no, because grammar to you is like something you're not good at. You need a better example than that.
It's like, don't think about a white elephant. It's like that. It's like, you know,
yeah,
it's that.
It's a lot like that.
I would go even further than that. Making Simpsons references is like using the letter H. It happens a lot, and you don't notice it.
And I'm trying to respond.
Don't let you say ow!
We established in our sort of pre-show build-up here that both Matt and Chris are tremendously good at doing the Pepper Pot voice, the Monty
it's
Python.
It's true!
And I, however, am completely not. I'm not even going to try. But
what a shame.
Yeah.
I like incest!
Yeah, not happening. You're looking lovely, Mother.
It's 3 o'clock. Time for your mother having sex with your sister on top of the television to explode. How did he know that was going to happen?
It was an inspired guess. So yes, Python references still fair game. I think we're now to the point where there are children growing up and don't know who Monty Python is, which is sad.
Poor bastards.
But I think it's starting to sort of slip into more obscurity, enough obscurity that we don't have to cut ourselves off from it. But The Simpsons, it's got to go.
Like that first generation that grew up not having been there for live Shakespeare plays and all the people. No, he was a bloody genius! You know, that's all their dick jokes. I don't like that.
Exactly. But so, yeah, that's the deal from now on. And we still haven't established, apart from the crossbow thing, which incidentally, listening to our last podcast, I think we kind of completely ran into the ground. But we need some kind of a good penalty, some kind of a good way to make us not do the things that we've sworn not to do. And if any of you out there listening have an idea, please let us know.
Perhaps a savage beating behind the dumpster.
Perhaps looking up Matt's old girlfriend and... letting her have a whack at...
knock, knock, knock. Hello? Matt, it's me! Pika! Your friend told me you were using Simpson references on your podcast!
Is that what she sounds like?
I've come to bury you in a shallow grave!
and
oh, ow.
And for me, it'll be like, it's your mother. I'm not wearing anything.
Never met anyone with purple underwear before.
Back to the Future, also fair game. And that brings me neatly. Here's a great segue. Oh, boy. Chris wanted to discuss bad comedy, and really, he could not have picked a better show to do it, honestly.
I didn't.
And as soon as he suggested it, we're just like, oh, this is a perfect setup for
this
us.
This is us!
I I love bad comedy since I moved to the city, New York City, in 93. And
you must have a smorgasbord of comedy clubs. And I can't imagine, like, the ratio of good to bad is not that high. So I imagine you had your pick of.
Yeah, well, what happens is when I first got here, I would go to the comedy clubs and we'd see.
And that was sort of the pinnacle, the peak, when comedy was likened to being a rock star and you could go to a comedy club and, you know, it was a big deal. Like, there was a scene at that point.
There was a scene and your end point was apparent because HBO had made, you know, kings of people like Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay had, you know, and Eddie Murphy and George Carlin before him, of course. So the club that I happened to go to was the one that Dave Chappelle met his writing partner, and they did Chappelle's show from there. But this was not a night that he was there, or at least
yeah. For every Dave Chappelle, you had 700,000 not Dave Chappelles,
right? And this was a night where HBO, somebody from HBO was going to be there watching.
Now, does that how it work? I actually have no idea. Do they send like a talent scout? Do they send like the proverbial record executive to watch the gig or, you know, whatever it is? Do they?
Yeah, HBO will send a scout or the people that have scouts in the clubs now, because and being a scout isn't like you're hired by the organization. It's like
I would imagine like a freelance gig where you
bring
them talent like a pitch and you say here's my funny and they.
Right. Well,
yes,
kind
no.
of. It's comedy is a community. It's very much a community exercise. Mm-hmm. So if you're a comic, you get hired by Kimmel or you get hired by Leno or Conan or Fallon at this point.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. One of the people that you know will be in the clubs. And if they recommend a new stand-up to be on the show, then they can bill themselves as talent bookers, whereas they're really just friends of the writers.
Well, and you see that I don't know so much now because I'm not really familiar with who the up and coming stand-ups are, or even if stand-up's a viable medium anymore. I'm not sure, but I remember sort of back in the day, you had guys that kind of ran together, and you had one or two guys come up and he'd say, "Oh, well, this is my good pal, whoever," and suddenly he'd be famous, and so, you know, like it
right.
Definitely, you got kind of a click atmosphere out of that whole.
Definitely, definitely, it's something that propagates itself and protects its own, and but anyway, this night, HBO had somebody there. The club for the people like for the guests of which I was one. They don't make it clear who the person from HBO is, but every comedian
they do say that there is someone from HBO there, though.
Right, because the host will say it because the host is nervous, and the host, being a comic, has to acknowledge what's making him uncomfortable.
Right,
you know, and so he says, you know, there's somebody from HBO, and then because this was a show that started at about midnight, everybody that went up was drunk. Everybody, from the pressure. From
I
pressure,
would imagine midnight is not a good time to start in a comedy club now that you mentioned
it. Well, it is and it is. It is if you're a pro. It just happened to be not a good night for this comedy club because these comedians were wrecked. Uh-huh. They were I love watching somebody, you know, try to walk that line of flirting and salaciousness and fail completely and basically, you know, do everything but ask for sex from somebody sitting in the front row. I had tears running down my face from how bad people were bombing. And that's my favorite bad comedy story.
Which and that's interesting.
Just when you watch people die.
on stage. It's,
I can completely get behind that.
And it's interesting because in our sort of little pre-show chat, we were talking about how Matt and I tend to not like the sort of and Matt, if I'm speaking for you incorrectly, let me know. Don't like the sort of comedy of the awkward, the sort of like the British Office and like
exactly.
The stuff that like Curb Your Enthusiasm, things that very much depend on you feeling awkward and feeling bad for the guy who's digging himself a deeper hole. And Chris was sort of singing the praises of that kind of stuff. And I see it as a legitimate form of comedy. I'm not saying that. It just makes me so uncomfortable. I can't laugh. And it sounds to me like you're getting a whole new level of that. You're seeing comedy of the awkward in real life.
Oh, yeah. It's
you're seeing Curb Your Enthusiasm right in front of you.
It's like
I got this thing where, like, if people don't have the good sense to be embarrassed for themselves, then I have to be embarrassed for them.
Which
is why I can't watch The Office anymore, because it's just like,
yeah, we're getting the same emotions out of it. I'm just processing it differently than you guys are, I guess.
I think that's probably true.
Sort of turn that into a feeling of joy and wonderment.
I always thought that that was sort of a British conceit, and then I realized that the Brits are better at that than anybody.
Yeah.
They've got that whole genre mastered. I mean, they were trying. Like, the American Office has some of that, but they realized, oh, Americans can't handle this. We're going to have to – look, Michael
Americans
Scott's likable.
Americans prefer weirdness.
It's hard to say that all Americans prefer anything, but I do think, you know, certain things are more marketable here than others. But yeah, that whole comedy, the awkward. I mean, because really, when you look at both versions of The Office, they both started with the same identical pilot script,
right?
And they departed in very different directions. And I think you kind of see the differences there in the cultures by the different directions that the show's headed. And I enjoy The American Office, and I appreciate the British Office for what it was. I just can't watch it.
Yeah.
And Chris, I know you probably love it. I would imagine you prefer it over the American.
Yeah, it was a revelation, but I haven't really processed any of that. You know, my act when it's performed, and it's been a while.
Actually, but real quick, I don't even think we actually specifically mentioned that you do stand up.
Oh, I do.
So we should say that before.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I do. I do stand up. I've been doing stand up on and off for 10 years. Mm-hmm.
You're approaching this going to a comedy club thing from a different perspective than we would.
Not at the time.
Okay.
Not at the time of this story. This is pre 99 was my debut. This had to be sometime after I moved to the city in 93.
All right.
So I mean that was the funniest thing. Having bombed since then.
Not so funny anymore, is it?
Sort of lost its luster.
Well, no, I mean I think it brought it even it makes it even more funny for me because it with comedy you don't learn that. It's not it's sort of the opposite of the do unto others. Right. It's that look, I go to a comedy club for enjoyment and for entertainment, and I'm going to get that. One way or another, I'm going to get that.
So help me God.
I mean, because a laugh is a laugh. Look, I feel like if you're up there and you're bombing and I'm in my seat laughing, I'm doing you a favor. You don't need to – even if you can figure out that I'm laughing at you and not with you, I'd appreciate the support. we're on the other end. You
that's
know?
That's a really fascinating way to look at it. I'm not that creative with my emotions. I'm so much more – instinctive, and I laugh if it's funny and I don't if it's not.
You've
so much more intellectualized this, and I really respect that about you. I can't put that much thought into what I, you know, a laugh to me is such an instinctive thing.
Well, I think you grow, maybe you grow a different, a set of antenna when you
go ahead and say it, a set of testicles. It's all right. We're all friends here.
Now keep saying it. Now repeat yourself.
Now you got another song.
Be more in testicles.
More testicles.
Got it.
Oh, I've had them removed. Oh, I did. Would you like to see them?
Your what? Testicle. sorry. Sorry.
No. Okay. No. Okay. By all means.
Call back to something nobody heard.
You're assuming. No, I think hearing this.
Yeah. Right. I think you do. I think you grow. Not a sixth sense in the metaphysical sense or any kind of supernatural sense, but once you've been up on stage, you have a feel for, you know, that sort of thing. And yeah,
there's definitely an instinct to comedy, even the sort of sterile comedy that I've tried to do and Matt has done with me, where you're sort of doing everything from your home, from the bunker, and sending it out into the world. Even then, there's an instinct.
But
there.
It's a different. Yeah, it's a different animal, though. It's
absolutely. Being in front of a live audience is totally different. I understand that entirely. Yes. All I'm saying is,
for one thing, I can do this.
If we had to do this in front of people, oh.
Hey, have you ever seen a man shit himself on stage? Well, you're gonna.
But, you know, we have one guaranteed laugh in the audience, so you think you're bombing, but, you know, Chris is laughing his ass off down there, so no, we're good.
Actually, but then to finally, you know, I can legitimize it all I want, but if I'm the only guy laughing, that's almost worse than nobody laughing.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of situations it can. When one guy's laughing, like...
Well, it makes me think of that scene in the De Niro Cape Fear.
Cape.
Yes,
not the Simpsons reference of not the Simpsons episode of the same name, mind you. The actual movie, right. Cape Fear. Just so we're clear, the reference.
De Niro intimidating Nick Nolte's family with his laugh. Yeah. That's exactly it. And it turns the whole audience. It brings the audience that's not laughing, the comedian, together.
Yeah.
Thinking, who is that retard laughing at these unfunny jokes?
I think they did that on Seinfeld too with what do you call it? The episode Jerry was like intentionally bombing, and the only one laughing in the audience laughing is Kramer.
Oh right, when he was taking tips from Banya.
Yeah, yeah, or exactly.
Banya had, yeah, Kenny.
Seinfeld is my kryptonite. Speaking of bad comedian and not doing, I never indulged and gone back.
I would accept the argument, and I don't think Matt would contradict me here either, that Seinfeld himself is not a particularly good comedian in terms of stand-up, in terms of him and his material is not that great.
He flat out does the airline joke.
He does. He'll do, you know, and these cab drivers, they don't even speak English, you know.
He does define a zeitgeist. I will give you that. You want to talk about 90s comedy or you know. I think Tom Hanks on Saturday Night Live, I hate to keep doing this. We jump around to these references, but he was doing a stand-up comedian. He did a parody.
I know exactly
of
what you're talking about now. There's that episode in the early 90s where he's Mr. No Depth Perception and Mr. Short-Term Memory.
And it's all with what's his name? Tommy Flanagan, the critic. Who am I thinking of?
I don't know. You lost me there.
No, he played the critic. He played...
Lovitz.
Yeah.
John Lovitz, yeah. He was in that episode and in that sketch. And it's, what's the deal with, you know, that's.
Oh, we may be talking about different things then. Tom Hanks did an appearance on SNL when I was in high school, 91, 92-ish. And every single sketch, every single character he played was a completely one-dimensional, one-note character.
Yeah. No, I think we're talking about the same episode. I think we're talking about the same episode.
And at first, it's like, this isn't funny. And after a while, it got kind of meta and it got really funny. Like, oh, I see what he's doing. These guys suck.
Right.
And it was basically Tom Hanks coming on to tell SNL that they weren't any good, is how I took that. Which is really bad because they were actually in a good period there. You had Phil Hartman and I think Dennis Miller was still there at that point, and Chris Rock was coming up, and you had some good guys there. But that was still great moments in meta comedy.
Yeah. Yes.
As far as other bad comedy, one series that comes to mind is did you guys see The Winner that aired last year?
The Seth MacFarlane show?
Yeah, yeah. It was Rob Corddry starring in Seth MacFarlane's live action sitcom
Seth MacFarlane is the Family Guy guy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not even me stepping in for the audience. I'm actually not sure.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I
never actually watched it because it looked terrible.
Yeah, it was. It was terrible.
Oh, and, good. I feel justified then.
And you have an audience, you know, trying to sell that laughter, and that's not nearly as funny.
Are they?
And maybe
still
it's,
doing live audience comedies.
Somebody is. I see it. I think they are. I think. I can't. But you know, the lack of an example probably speaks to your point.
No, I don't. I don't watch a lot of, and I mentioned this before. I don't watch a lot of live TV. I DVR things. I watch it on DVD. I don't know what's on. I usually sort of, and I miss probably a lot of good stuff this way. But I sort of depend on word of mouth to filter down to me and say, you know, for a Chris or a Matt to say this is good. And if both of you say that, then I'll watch it.
Can I break in here? You just reminded me of something that I've wanted to talk to you for about a little while.
All right.
I heard somebody recently said. On some other podcast or somewhere that one of their pet peeves is these TiVo guys that will break into a conversation and go, oh, I don't watch commercials.
Really?
And as if somebody coming in and saying that they don't watch commercials is somehow annoying to you.
I can see that be annoying, and I will totally cop to being that guy.
I am bragging about my TiVo guy. We are.
Don't run up to random people. I don't watch commercials.
In the early part of this decade, I probably did that. Now that the novelty's worn off, maybe not so much.
we are both early TiVo adopters, uh-huh. and I recognize that in you. So when I heard this guy say, just stop that. Just stop that, guys. Everybody sees commercials.
I don't.
There's a whole segment of the population that has adopted this technology in order to not do that.
We're about a decade into it. I mean, yeah, I got my TiVo. I remember specifically I got it after 9/11. I was under that naive when the government was saying spend money, keep the economy going, and I said
yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, I believed it and I bought into it, and I went and bought a TiVo. So that's how I know when I got TiVo. It was like 9/15/01.
I'm 10 years in. I got it after Time came out with its Inventions of the Year. Issue in 98 or 99. Nice. I know I got it in 99, but I just don't remember.
Yeah, so we're both. I mean, you win. Right. if that's what you're going for there. But we've both been doing
it. Meanwhile, Canada just got TiVo last week.
I kind of – what this led to for me was that this person was being disingenuous to generate content. Because how could you really have a problem with – you're talking about a commercial for something that you shouldn't have even been watching. You should have been getting up and doing something else when the commercial came on. In the first place, so how can you?
We've adopted that workaround for commercials since the 50s. I mean, that's not
exactly.
What they're there for. You go pee and get a drink of water.
Exactly. Or radio guys can take their breaks. TV people can.
Right.
It's nice for everybody. Until the viewer wants and can have more control, and then anyway, that bugged me, and it's something I wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah, that's you definitely. You definitely hit on something that I do, and I've been called out for that before, and it really isn't bragging. It's just I'm trying to establish, hey, I don't have that frame of reference. I'm not
right.
It's not like, I'm too good for commercial. It's no, my viewing habits currently aren't,
It's not something that's call outable. It's not that's my whole point in bringing up the issue is that look, this, yeah. we're just gay. we didn't choose this.
Yeah, we were
don't
born
call
this way.
Exactly.
Don't be a TiVophobe. That was a bit of a stretch. When
you're marching in your TiVo parade next summer, I'll keep that in mind.
Lois Lane, capital T, lowercase I.
Capital V, yeah. It's spelled TV. It's not that hard.
Little happy television set.
Oh, yeah, right. But on that subject... mm-hmm. I am noticing sort of with Facebook and with a few other things on the internet, and now I'm drawing a blank what it's called, contextual advertising, where things sort of learn your habits and learn what you like.
Ugh.
No, I like this, actually. I support this, and I'll tell you, on Facebook, I have taken the time to give the little thumbs up or thumbs down to enough ads that it's starting to advertise things to me I might actually consider looking at.
See, I just – that creeps me out because just like, God, now it means someone's watching me. Man, I look at a lot of porn.
But is it someone or something? I mean, I'm not – I agree that it's creepy, but it's like there's no guy sitting there. No, I mean, you're not
– Nobody's judging you. Well, they're probably judging you, but no one's judging us.
But see, and I mean like I know it's a program, but then it's just like, oh, great. So that program is judging me.
No, they're aggregating the data that goes in a – in a report for someone
when the revolution comes, Matt will beat you to death with vibrators.
Isn't the downside, I guess the downside of old versus new is that I guess a few years ago, they were selling, a Dr. King. They were selling Malcolm X or some Martin Luther King biography or Eyes on the Prize or something like that. And Amazon's, it was a civil rights documentary.
Well, this is a setup for hilarity already, but let me see what's going with this.
Amazon recommended Planet of the Apes as part of and people or it
oh,
was
that's
it,
the worst.
It was either wasn't Amazon, it was Target. It was Target that did it. And and you could tell it was a programmatic problem because one of the Planet of the Apes movies, or the one that they were advertising, was an allegory for civil rights. I mean, it actually had
right.
It actually had a basis in the program was right. It's just when you looked at it,
yeah. You need that human element in there. You need common sense to say, "Whoa, better not
right.
Better not let that slip through."
Right, and I think as we get further into the 21st century, I think that people will recognize that nobody's there being racist. Nobody's there.
You think we'll teach a computer the meaning of racism and teach it how to avoid?
I just think that people will understand that these slip-ups are not worthy of calling in Al Sharpton.
I don't know. That's true. Yeah.
People won't realize that.
I don't think so. I just don't see that.
No, I think people like us, thinking sensible, rational people, will think that. But there's always going to be your knee-jerk reactionaries who are going to say, you know, who look for any excuse, and certainly not just race. I mean, there are people who cry homophobia over anything. There are people who cry, and I don't want to get too political or anything, but there are, everyone knows the guy who's far too sensitive and just needs to lighten up a little bit. And those are the people I'm talking about.
Right, right.
And it's not any one specific group, except the Jews. But other than that, it's really no one specific group. God, I hate them so much. So that said,
you're listening to Racist Voyages with Al.
Oh boy,
Matt,
it's racist.
Is this where the hate cast at? For the hate cast.
Oh no, you had to go southern with that.
I did. The actual hate cast is run out of New York by a very nice cosmopolitan young reporter named Amelie.
I see.
There is a hate cast.
Really?
It's good.
Is it actually called Hate Cast?
It's run out of the Onion. It's the Onion AV cast. The Onion AV has a AV club. They have their own thing. And then one of their columnists gets peeved about stuff like that. This is exactly the kind of – her cast is the kind of podcast that would have – something about getting upset at people that don't watch commercials. Except she is more rational about it, and she actually.
So it's like an Andy Rooney thing. Like, have you ever noticed how people?
Yeah. Her last one was about conservatives taking the films of Judd Apatow, or any film really, and saying that it was good because it was conservative. And
that's actually not a bad riff if you do it right, because
the desires of the filmmaker, like the conservative read of The Dark Knight, I guess, is that George Bush was Batman. Did you hear this last summer?
I've heard that.
My
mind is melting down at trying to reconcile one of my favorite superheroes and one of my least favorite human beings simultaneously.
Right.
I can't do it.
Yeah, that's a
no, but listen. The read, their read, which I disagree with, is that, you know, George Bush made himself the anti-hero, as Batman did in The Dark Knight. He made himself hated by the population in order to do what's right. It's as simple as that.
That he was sort of taking a hit for the greater good?
Right, okay. Right. That's the argument, at least as it applies to this Dark Knight discussion.
Okay.
I guess the conservative read on Knocked Up by Judd Apatow is that they had the baby and they didn't abort, so therefore it's a conservative coup there.
Right.
And I don't know what the read is on Funny People, but this hate cast illuminated that for me, that there's this sort of there's a wing of conservatism that will identify good movies and then call them conservative.
Oh, and that's been going back at least as far back as like Forrest Gump. I remember that.
Sure,
oh,
sure, yeah. Sure. Sure. Probably well beyond.
Yeah. But
anyway.
Bad comedy.
Bad hole.
Right. We actually Chris and I keep wanting to call him Fourth Man because that's how I refer to
either
him
one,
online. But
either one, Chris,
yeah,
Fourth Man.
It's one of those weird things in person. Like you don't use the like I go by because I've gone by Algar long before. I was on the internet. It's just a thing. But
yeah, I love your commitment to that, by the way.
What's that?
I love your commitment to Algar. I love
for me, it's easier to keep the personal life and the sort of, you know, it's like a pen name. It's like, if someone calls my house asking for Algar, it's probably someone I want to talk to. If someone calls asking for Ron, it's probably a bill collector or my mother. And
certainly not Morpheus.
Wondering if you're wearing purple underwear.
Oh, that's never going to go away, is it?
Not if I can help it.
Good man. Where was I going with that? Oh,
Now you're just trapped by the image of your mother asking if you wear purple underwear.
I am, actually. She's kind of hot.
Oh, Al, you and your incest.
Wow, I think always
incesting you.
I think between that and my recently outed anti-Semitism, you owe us one now. I think my attempt to put us on even ground with the furries thing is sort of backfired, and now you have to be, you know, equally hateable.
Yeah, good luck on that.
And what do you what's in your closet, Matt? What's in your hate closet?
Box of creepy porn?
No, you love that.
Come on, that's not hateable.
No,
I don't know if it's a skeleton. I mean, there's literal skeletons in there.
there's our cover art
from those drifters I killed.
And kudos for not falling back on Hobo, by the way.
Yeah, Hobo is becoming Mexican of 2009.
I was really sad that, like, hobos become mainstream, because I was enjoying that long before it was popular.
It's true. And even, like, 5 years ago, you and I were having long discussions over it's not a hobo unless he has a bindle. And
yeah, exactly.
But I would say the very excellent John Hodgman, unfortunately, has said everything there is to be said on the subject. Reading 700 hobo names, I can't imagine anyone has any further, you know, punctuation for that sentence.
Where did Hodgman do that?
Oh god! It was in his first book.
What is it? I can't.
Oh, I know it. I know the book.
Is it more information than you require, or is that the second?
No, that's
book?
A sequel. Oh god, I can't believe I don't remember this.
The areas of my expertise.
That's the
yes.
One.
Thank you.
But in the audiobook, at the end of it, he literally reads 700 hobo names.
Wow.
That's it. Just one right after the other. Boxcar Willie.
Tin Boxcar,
yeah, just on and on and on, and they didn't even edit it. Like there's bits where he says stand by, and you can tell he's like going for a drink of water or something, and then he'll resume. I think they just sat him in the studio for a couple hours and said, "Here, go."
Sounds like a carnival atmosphere, almost a carnival barker atmosphere to his.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, apparently in his second in the audiobook for the second book, he's doing mole man names.
Like yeah,
guys who live in subterranean realm. And for this one, I did see him talking on Twitter. He's going somewhere, I believe in New York, doing a live read of these names, and that was it. And he made it very clear, look, I'm not doing shtick, I'm not doing a show, I'm reading these names and going home. If you want to come, great, we're not going to charge you any money for it, but don't expect material. We're just recording for the book. Yeah, and Jonathan Colton's there with him playing a loop of 20 seconds of music over and over and over again. And it's just a great little piece of performance art. I mean, I love that guy. He's fantastic. But really, as far as hobos go, I think he's kind of put the nail in that coffin. So
yeah,
speak.
I think
so.
The days of wine and hobos are pretty much over.
The literal coffin that is in Matt's closet, apparently.
Yes, exactly. It's not so much a coffin as it is a bucket.
Nice. Well, once you debone them, I suppose there's not a lot left.
No, it's
will
just
it bled?
That is the question.
So, awful segue time. No, what I was saying is that Chris and I had discussed at some length what ruins a comedian's life.
Right.
We look at guys, and we talked about this previously, guys like Steve Martin, guys like Eddie Murphy, who were hilarious 15, right. 20 years ago, or even Chevy Chase, who peaked a little quicker and dropped a little quicker, and wonder what happened. And Chris in particular, I think, had some interesting insights on that. Real quick, it started, I was ragging on you and it was completely in jest. I didn't mean it because I haven't actually seen your stand-up, so I couldn't say one way or the other. But you had a kid not too long ago. And
I did.
So I went to the natural, easy joke of, you know, well, your stand-up sucks now because you got a kid. And then he kind of schooled me on that, so.
Not really. I mean, I think that it's an easy, if you're not dedicated to it, if you're using stand up as a stepping stone to acting, if you're using it to a different career, then having a kid sucks all the time that you would have out of writing. But it also, I think we talked about it earlier, you know, it's all about honesty. Comedy is, you know, really good comedy is all about honesty. And
what right do you have to be that honest about this person that doesn't have a say in the world yet? And so you sort of back off, or you make all your comedy nice, or you make it safe.
Well, and we talked a bit about Cosby, of course. Some of his best material came from parent-related stuff, but it was
right.
It was very clean. And we right. got into sort of a discussion over clean versus safe. You say that they're not exactly the same thing.
No, they're not. They're not, because he was willing to go and talk about his kids, and he was willing to say that he hated them and not care that they might be too young to understand that he doesn't really hate them.
And he still came off I would say his overall image was still very much of a loving father.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like he could get up and say, "Oh, I hate my kids, and I can't."
Right.
You know, but
and maybe risk alienating the audience, because that you know he has enough confidence that he's funny to pull that off. But you if you're writing that down and or like Carlin writing, I think kids are assholes, and Carlin doesn't disabuse you of the notion.
Well, yeah, and I'll actually say this. My parents got the opportunity to see him. I unfortunately did not, and this will stick in my craw for the rest of my fucking life.
And rightly so. Jeez.
I had tickets to see Carlin, the last tour he made, the last pass through Seattle here. And my job at the time, which was a good job, and if I still had it, it might be okay. I don't anymore. Sent me out of town that week. I also had tickets to see They Might Be Giants. I've seen them before. I'll see them again. But what? I had tickets to see Carlin, and I had to forfeit them. Fortunately, I was able to at least get money for them. Chris Page, who lives near here, who will be on the show hopefully coming up, bought him off.
I like.
Saw the show. Great show. And he told me all about it. And then, of course, Carlin dropped dead.
Like a day later.
Yeah. No, and at the time, I even said, and I say this about guys who are old, I say, he's going to be dead soon. I need to go see him. That's what I said. I bought tickets.
Yeah.
I paid, like, $50 a ticket because I knew.
No, I remember.
If they're in a Pixar, you know, a good sign is, and this isn't true of Carlin, but if they're in a Pixar movie and they're old, that's going to be their last credit.
Chances are, yeah, they just wanted to get that one last thing in.
Madeline Kahn, Tim McDowell.
But I never got a chance to see him live, unfortunately. My parents saw him in Vegas. My parents go to Vegas from time to time, and they saw him. You know, they had probably comp tickets because they spend a fair amount of money out there, and they get a lot of free stuff.
Right.
And I remember having this conversation with my mom because she's kind of a younger mom, and she was kind of hip when I was growing up, and she was, you know, a kid in the 60s and 70s. So she gets Carlin. Like she's not one of those, you know, old lady prudes. Like she understands Carlin. She hated it because he got up there with that fuck the children stuff.
Right.
We know how to take that.
Right.
My parents did not.
Yeah. It's you know, having a child takes over so many parts of your life that you've got to be a really good writer to not process, you know, what it is about that's funny.
Well, and you talk about risk. Carlin, at that point in his career, took a big risk. And to him, what's the difference if my mom or, you know, people in that
right.
certain age bracket aren't paying attention anymore. He's still saying what he wants to say. And
well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, at that point, you know, it's not like, you know.
Yeah, we're talking 2003, 2004 here. I mean, he's
yeah,
not
exactly.
Gonna...
Right, right. I appreciate that. I appreciate a comedian that can write an act that doesn't fall. You know, it's the same problem that that leads a lot of people to say that women aren't funny, because there's a certain segment of female comedians that will say, "Hey, ladies, am I right?"
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
When you're a parent, you're not saying it, but you're basically saying, "Hey, parents, am I right?" You're dividing your audience, and you're only speaking to a segment of them when you want to only talk about, you know, how cute your kids are, or
I would take that a step further and say there are comedians who do that in all segments. You got.
Right.
You got your, you know, the black comedians who are like, you know, well, black guys are like this, but white guys are
right.
like this. You know, anybody who does that divisive thing, or if you get, you know, like some guy who's just out there being a stereotypically flaming homosexual saying, you know, well, you know, am I right? I mean, straight people are like this. And I mean, it doesn't
right.
matter. There's one for every.
If you can transcend that, like Carlin or like, you know. Even a Seinfeld or a Cosby, you've got my respect, because.
Or even turn it around, like you take someone like Richard Pryor, who would just sort of wear that stuff on his sleeve. And going back and watching his older stuff and realizing he did do a lot of that, you know, black guys be like this, white guys be like this. But
he invented it.
Yeah,
he invented
it. And he was able to pull it off. And I don't know why, but he
was. Well, because it wasn't hack yet. Because it was still dangerous to talk about.
I think there's more. I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right. But I think there's more to it than that. I think something about his delivery, something about the way he structured that material made it. It wasn't just that it hadn't been heard before. I think there was some inherent talent of his.
Oh, absolutely. It's that you're coming off the civil rights movement and the stressing that we're equal.
Right.
And I think that here's the thing about equality. Whenever anybody gets it, whether it be this gay marriage equality or equality, that means the warts. And the people that speak to equality, the people that speak to equality always play down the warts.
Right.
And it's the people that will speak to the warts at the same time, like prior to, like, yeah, we're equal, which means if I get a lot of money, I'm going to be doing drugs just like all the white people that have all the money. You know, I mean, that's one of the things he was saying. It's part of what makes him a genius is that he hit at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, he came up what in late '60s, early '70s, like,
right.
And yeah, I mean, that's definitely what the hell's going on over there?
You okay over there?
We are having a thunderstorm.
Ah,
at the moment.
Oh, nice.
Not that's not what that was, but but we are having one.
Just tearing shit down in your computer area.
Oh, yeah. I'm
so passionate about this. Give me that crumb. Painting.
Crumb crisp paint, what coating.
You picturing his crumb crisp coating? That's tough. You ever want to stop me in mid thought? Just throw one.
That's why I hope you run for office someday. Oh. As mayor, I hope to crumb crisp coating.
No, I'm just going to embrace it. I'm going to put the giant Citizen Kane poster behind me.
Oh, fuck. That would be awesome.
And I'll be up there ranting about Boss Jim Gettys.
It'd be like the Manchurian Candidate. Have a Asian guy in the audience say, "Crumb crisp coating."
What a timely reference for me! I don't know if you did that on purpose or not, but I just watched that movie like a week ago for this film class I'm taking.
Oh, Al, you and your Manchurian Candidate!
What a great fucking movie! Of course, I'm talking about the original. I didn't see the remake. It might be good. I don't know.
It is actually Denzel.
Okay, I won't just dismiss it out of hand because there are some elements in there that appear to know, like the director and the star appear to know what they're doing. So maybe it's all right. But the original is a lot better than you think it is. You hear there's a movie with, if I just sold you on, it's a spy thriller with hypnosis and Frank Sinatra is the lead and Angela Lansbury is the villain.
Sold.
Yeah. sold on camp value though, not on, truly like truly scary thriller, which it really
is. There is some of that in there though. Specifically, and I mean camp, because specifically I'm talking about when Sinatra is discussing the mechanics of hypnosis. And he goes, "You gotta get all those cuckoo parts out of your brain."
It's true. There were some Sinatra-isms definitely in there.
Yeah. You're all messed up inside, and you got to bust out. You're all cuckoo crazy.
That's true. And I was laughing at it at the time, and I did kind of block that out because so much of the rest of the movie did impress me. But you're absolutely right.
It's great. It's great. But Sinatra.
Yeah.
That's the reason I like the remake, because Sinatra is not the actor that Denzel Washington is. And you know, I don't know who gets the hate mail off the podcast, but I'm one of the few that thought that a remake was called for.
Really?
Not because the original.
I would disagree with you just on that point, but
okay.
But continue.
Okay. But just for the lead, just because I've never thought much of Sinatra as an actor.
Oh, see, no, I disagree, because I went in expecting, oh God, it's a singer playing it, and I was really impressed. And maybe because I had the lower expectations, that helped. But
you know what else I dislike about the original is the fact that somebody says go jump in a lake, and they play that joke out straight. And maybe it had a little less I don't know, a little less silly in the 60s when that was a much more common phrase.
Could be.
You know?
I don't know. I mean, we can certainly disagree on this. Just if you think that the remake is a worthwhile,
I don't think
endeavor
it's
a, and all
I
that.
Think it's worthwhile. I don't think it's superior. I think it was called for.
Fair enough. I will say Denzel Washington is one of those actors like Sean Penn, like there's a couple others who I acknowledge are very talented, and I have not seen a single movie with them in it and probably never will.
Wow, really?
It's one of the and I'm going to get called out real bad for my terrible taste in film, and I embrace that wholeheartedly. You're correct in saying that.
Oh, no, I'm not. I just
every single movie, like I know Denzel's good. I've seen enough clips. I've flipped through enough things over the years. I know he's a great actor. No movie he does interests me in the slightest. I just don't care. Oh. And the same with Sean Penn. The same with there's a whole group of guys that I know are like Oscar caliber guys, and I don't care.
Wow, that's kind of respectable. These guys are shoved down our throats. I mean, once they show any sign of talent. These A-listers are shoved down our throats as far as, like, it's very hard to avoid these people. And I'm definitely somebody that is considers himself discriminating about what goes into his eye holes.
Oh, absolutely. I won't make any bones about this. I am often intimidated talking to you about entertainment because you do have this sort of respect for good movies, and you know, here I am watching Back to the Future for the thousandth time, and let's pop in some Star Wars after that, and you know,
I was so jealous. I was so jealous of that recent Back to the Future discussion because I am a huge.
Well, and it's not to say you don't appreciate movies like that either, but anything that runs over 2 hours, anything with a little depth to it that kind of makes my eyes glaze over, you're there.
Oh, I see. No, but I absolutely hold. Back to the Future in that kind of esteem where it's an Academy Award winning screenplay for a reason. And you guys pointed out in the first draft discussion was just amazing where you were talking about all the little details that got left out. And
oh yeah.
It's totally
it's a fascinating read that first draft of the script, by the way.
It is. It's like that. I have to send you another Alan Moore story.
Okay.
Have you ever read the one, where Dave Gibbons draws the same panel over and over again, and it's a time travel story, and after a while you begin to realize that the two characters that are in the forefront of the frame, the two characters that are the focus of the frame, are appearing over and over again in different disguises, in different parts of the as different other couples in the same frame, because they keep coming back to that same moment in time. And they don't want to call attention to the fact that they're their past and future selves.
I have not read this, Matt.
Wow. No, I've never heard of this one before.
You're a lot more steeped in that stuff than I am. I thought.
Yeah, no shit. What is this?
This is he did a collect. He used to work for 2000 AD, you know. The,
right. No,
is that magazine. You sent me when we spoke about Norman Normal. You right. Thought it was a reference to this Alan Moore comic that had some character named Normal in it, and you sent that to me. That was great. Was that from that as well?
It's the same collection, or two. He's got two collections called Shocking. One's called Shocking Futures, and the other one is called Twisted Times. Uh-huh. And so you see that he all these short stories that he's written, and it's about I don't know 15, 20 per collection with some really great artists working. Early
sure,
in their
when he was doing that 2000 AD stuff, it was what, like early to mid 80s? So all those guys became sort of superstars were just coming up at that point.
Right. Yeah. Like Carlos Tierra and Steve Dillon. Mm-hmm. And I know Ennis. I know a lot of the writers wrote for this, but these collections are all Alan Moore. And in this one, it's a pre Watchmen teaming of Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. Nice. And it's two time cops. Mm-hmm. And so he approaches that. You know, I don't want to give away the ending, but they're jumping. They have to jump through time back to the same moment. And as you're reading it, it's almost like a choose your own adventure, except he reuses the same panel. And every time he reuses it, your attention is called to a different place in the panel where two people are walking through the causeway. And you realize that it's the same, that eventually everybody is just those two people.
Wow. So,
that sounds very Alan Moore.
That sounds awesome.
I think you're going to have to give me some details on that.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll just send it to you. I have I'll send you the name of it, rather.
Yeah.
Yes. Of
course. No, but I think we need, like, if there is a way to obtain those legally, I'd definitely like to put that in our show notes.
Sure.
Yeah.
We're going to have to wrap up here. We're unfortunately hitting a time bump here. Enjoying this. Really sad to do that. Really quick before we go, you mentioned Time Cops, which reminds me of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which reminds me of a thing we were talking about before we jumped on here.
Sure.
You did an impression of Avery Brooks as Captain Sisko that has to be shared. We got to get this recorded. So
just for explanation's sake, it was on a Larry King interview that I learned to do this. Larry King interviewed the cast of Deep Space Nine, and
I'm gonna Avery do Brooks everything is, I can to dig up a link to that so we can share that with everyone, because I got to see that myself.
Avery Brooks has his own little vocal trope where he, as you put it, calls and responds to himself, where he'll say, you know, I was walking down the what street, and I. And a what was coming down the street? Car. And so I learned to do this, and it is, I can't believe the Cardassians are attacking once again.
Fantastic. Chris, that alone is the price of admission.
Oh.
Thank you. Guys, I'm a fan of the show, and thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, God.
Absolutely. Sir. You'll be back. If you're willing, you'll absolutely be back.
Anytime.
I'll have something to promote next time, Matt. It's been an honor to meet you.
You too.
I think I'm going to be doing some stand up in the coming season.
Anytime you have any information, let us know. We will plug the hell out of that. You will be definitely. And stand by. We have a bit of viewer mail to go through, or listener mail rather. If you don't mind staying on, helping us get through that. But thanks for being on.
Letters from the audience.
Okay, our first question comes via MP3.
Hey, Ron and Matt, this is Jeremy from Destroy All Podcast DX. Just want to drop you a little feedback here on your show. I've been enjoying it a lot. However, portmanteau, you're on a podcast. Portmanteau podcast. Think about it.
Well, Matt, that was lovely.
What do you have to say to that?
What was the guy's name?
Jeremy.
All right, Jeremy. Oh, you figured it out. You're smarter than us. So, you know, you'll be receiving a solid gold statue of us bowing down to you and how smart you are. So, you know, enjoy that. It'll be diamond studded and with platinum edgings.
Sounds like Jeremy's trying to make a dick of me.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I couldn't top either of those answers, so let's move on.
Keep listening, Jeremy.
one of our many friends from the United Kingdom named Gav, we have several of those.
They are legion.
It's true. English Gav, as opposed to Irish Gav, asks, if a sequel is set after, being sequential ordering, and a prequel is set before or previous to, what would you call another film that is set concurrently? I've gone with requel, as it's revisiting the same time frame. Any other suggestions or comments on my choice, or is there an established one I've missed and will now be laughed at?
I believe the scientific term is equal. Thank you very much.
Ooh, nice. I know Asia does that a lot, where they it's not really revisiting the same events, but they'll take the same characters and put them into a different situation, which I guess is like it's almost an alternate reality.
Don't make Simpsons Rashomon reference. Don't make Simpsons Rashomon reference.
Rosh equal, I guess.
I was doing well up until you had to start talking about it, like pulling off a scab, right?
You may be right about other markets doing that, but I can't think of an American film that's ever done that, that's ever been set concurrently with events from a previous film.
Well, video games are doing it now, and the Cloverfield sequel threatens to do that.
I suppose Back to the Future kind of, like Back to the Future 2.
Yeah.
It jumped around, but the meat of the story was sort of concurrently with, which is what I loved about it.
Sure.
But
it was one movie, but like Pulp Fiction was doing that, where like, you know, a bunch of things happening at the exact same time.
I don't think that counts because there's a lot of movies that do that.
All right, it's fine.
All right, so moving on. incidentally, this question, I can tell before I even read it to you, is bait. Matt, please, please don't take the bait. I beg you. It looks shiny and delicious, but don't take it. Brewtown Andy, a friend of ours on Twitter and elsewhere, asks, how awesome is your podcast?
Well, Andy, our podcast is by far the most awesomest podcast currently available. More awesome than Smodcast, more awesome than anything that the CBC puts out. More awesome than The Onion, more awesome than insert podcast name here.
I'll have to concur with you there. I believe if you were to create a scale of awesome podcasts, that ours would have to be unequivocally on the top of that pyramid, and all other podcasts would be sort of below that in sort of a general triangle shape.
Yeah, it's really just you can't get a better podcast than our podcast, okay?
I thought it was six awesome. I thought that
we were almost clear. We almost had it in your head.
Well,
sorry.
Chris will not be asked back to the show.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Musical interlude. Once upon a time back in 91, I was hanging with my pals just having some fun. And when I say fun, I use the term loosely. Say our town was thrilling is to put it obtusely. Remember that night, just as clear as a bell, it was me and LG plus Mark, Jen, and Mel. Vinegar sub potatoes are what Jason's craving. Dashing in the dashing for some craven staving. On the hunt for snacks, I find myself distracted. To the caffeine pills, I'm apparently attracted. Purchase six packs from the small convenience store. That's 1,200 milligrams if you're keeping score. First thing I felt was a brain orgasm. Then I looked down and I'm starting to spasm. Nearly didn't live to see 17. Please heed my warning. Be careful with caffeine. Then there was the great caffeine draught of Odd 2. There's no greater sin in my point of view. No, I'm a man who enjoys his jolt. Throw my hands in the air and yell like Steve-O! This particular summer, the stuff couldn't be had. I was living on coffee and I was raving mad. I went on a quest to right this wrong, and my wife at the time, she got dragged along. I hit every store from here to Fort Eustis. No one had Jack, Dick, Zilch, Bubkiss. Across this great land and on the internet, it was all dried out like a charcoal briquette. Now the woman I mentioned, she's no longer my wife, but at least I got that cola back in my life. You're probably not wrong to call me obscene. What can I say? I love caffeine. If Ritalin was a woman, I'd make her my bride, but it's caffeine that I would bang on the side. I'm sure it's unnatural to lust for a chemical, but to say otherwise would be plain polemical. I love it when I get that first morning shiver, and unlike booze, it won't wreck my liver. 8 atoms of carbon and 10 made of hydrogen, 4 atoms of N, and the last 2, they're oxygen. Psychoactive, hyperactive, wonderful stimulant. Caffeine's my lover, and TV's my parent. You can take my caffeine if you just understand. You'll have to pry it out of my shaking dead hand. Data said it best when he said with a laugh that your coffee never go decaf. My name is Al, my hair is vivid tangerine. I suck at rapping, but I love caffeine. The Sarcastic Voyage podcast is published bi-weekly and is available via iTunes or on the web at algar.com. Audience feedback can be sent to podcast@algar.com or sent via Twitter to @algar. The Sarcastic Voyage podcast is written and produced by Ron Algar Watt and the featured guests, unless otherwise noted. All material contained herein is the property of Ron Algar Watt. Copyright 2009, Algar Productions.